Well, that's my intro. Welcome to Melkor, the podcast where I show. Yes, okay, I remember.
I love you. Oh my God. Okay.
Welcome to Melkor, the podcast where I, Laura, show my cool friend Panya the music that I like. There she is. Which is mostly hard rock and heavy metal. What is she saying? Get the cat translator.
There is no cat translator. You have to have a real person. You cannot automate that.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Every cat has left the room. So we got nothing. We got nothing.
We don't have the specialists. Do you have sun today?
Yes, actually, we have so much sun. Yesterday, it taunted me with sun when I woke up, and then literally, I swear, I went to put on people clothes and go outside, and the second I set foot in the bedroom, the clouds came in. Oh my God, it was so annoying. But today, I don't see.
People clothes.
I guess. I wasn't going to go outside in my pajamas.
Hmm. That's pajama goss. Anyway.
I'm wearing pink pajamas, okay?
Okay.
I don't think I qualify as goth right now in any way.
Yeah. And today it's sunny.
Today there does not even seem to be a cloud in the sky.
Mm-hmm. Well, today then we can listen to some sad songs, some blues.
Oh, blues are not necessarily sad songs.
Only some of them, like 50% are sad.
They might be melancholy, which is not quite the same as sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to listen to a gentleman from Belfast, Northern Ireland. His name is Gary Moore.
So we're doing quite a change from last time's episode.
What did we do last time?
Well, the last recording we did was Ghost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was about time for Ghost. I deviated from my timeline. Now we're back on the timeline.
I believe it's always time for Ghost.
It was about time for Ghost.
Okay.
It's time to show you Ghost. So we are at the end of the 70s. I think the song that I chose to go first was from an album from 78.
Let me see. So, I don't think I've ever heard of this guy. So, tell me about this guy.
I think the first bigger band that he was in was called Skid Row. And he was in that one with Phil Lynott, who later formed Thin Lizzy.
Okay.
He stayed in Skid Row a bit longer. That was during the 70s. And then at some point, he joined Thin Lizzy and did a couple of albums with them. A couple of tours, and then his solo career began, which really really took off in the mid 80s, as far as I remember.
Okay, so this may be a case where I recognize some of the songs but wasn't aware of who made them.
Mm-hmm. I think the first one, the fourth one, Still Got the Blues, you will recognize at some point. So, yeah, let's listen to Parisian Walkways, where Gary is playing and singing also. But I think it's Phil Lynott that sings the verses.
Okay. Let's listen to Parisian Walkways by Gary Moore. That sounded like it belongs to the sort of video where you have the pretty girl and the guy walking through fields of flowers with their hands trailing in it and the sun and the camera is angled so you're looking up at them and they don't do anything except walk through it and trail their hands in the flowers.
Oh, okay. That's a nice picture. Where did you see videos like that?
Oh, gosh.
Like, what's it typical of?
I can't even remember. I think I've actually often seen that kind of thing in commercials of all the stupid things.
Mm.
but
What,
it's
because of the
just,
guitar melody?
yeah, because of the guitar. And it's also true that often these kinds of images are associated with, like, the flowers are often lavender, and I know that lots of lavender is grown in a commercial sense in France, so there may have been that association in my head too. But yeah.
A bit melancholic, this one. Yeah, it's
A
not really
little,
sad.
and yet it don't, yeah, I don't think of that as being a sad song, but I don't, it's obviously not rock, duh. But it's not the sort of song that I would listen to if I was sad. I would listen to that when I take my book and some noms and just go sit outside, and there's giant bumblebees humming past, and the grass hasn't been mown in 3 weeks, so it's full of little flowers and tall bits, and everything smells like amazingness, and I can't hear the road. Like, it's that kind of song.
Nice.
You don't listen to that when you're driving. It's too slow for that.
I see. And the way Phil sang it sounded like he was just narrating.
A
He
little.
didn't
There was
say so.
some lyricness to it, but it didn't sound, the emotion of it didn't sound immediate. It was reminiscent. And so melancholy in the way that even if it's a good memory, it's possible to be melancholy when remembering something because it's past and all you have is the memory. That's what that felt like.
I could write a few paragraphs. And Gary was singing the higher voice and
The
playing solo
descant.
guitar. What is that?
Descant.
Is that like a, does it come from Latin?
I don't know where it comes from. I just know that whenever there is a higher lyric line, that's what it's usually referred to. I am most familiar with it in a choral sense where the soprano line is often called a descant. I may be
I see.
mispronouncing that.
Okay, the stress is on the first syllable, descant.
So I do have it right. Okay. Thought so.
Okay. So let's get another song where both Gary and Phil are playing.
Okay.
Let's listen to one that they dedicated, that was inspired by the this long civil war that they had in Ireland. It's called Out in the Fields, and let's watch the music video.
Wait. Is this the one where is this the quote civil war that is referred to by the Irish as the Troubles because they think they're funny?
Oh, I don't even know. I just know that there was a lot of killing and terrorism, and I remember the IRA was involved.
So
I
probably
wasn't
is
even
what they
sure I should
refer to
say
the
civil war.
Troubles. Probably is what they refer to as the Troubles, which, wow, that's
Just
discussing
troubles.
that is genuinely a whole podcast all by itself.
I don't
Wow.
know anything about it,
I know some about it. It's not something I've done a lot of in-depth research into. The current research I'm doing right now definitely covers the events that led to the Troubles from like 400 years back, because it's true. We'll do this little brief bit. It's true that one of the driving causes of problems in Ireland to this day is the issue of religion. And so the roots of the Troubles, the roots of the IRA, of a lot of that stuff come down to the fact that the Protestant Reformation happened and that the Anglican Church was created, and that there was probably 100 to 150 years of conflict all across Europe between Catholics and Protestants.
But it got really sore in Ireland.
It got really sore everywhere, honestly. Ireland is not special in that sense.
No, not into the 20th century, not in France, for example.
That's true. That is quite true. It has lasted longer in Ireland, although I think the causes, the current causes shifted in the 20th and in the 21st century. So that's true. But at least at the time, look up the 30 Years' War for starters. But yeah, I've decided to study that bit of history right now. So a whole bunch of the early history of that conflict is crammed into my head at the moment. Anyway, okay, so let's watch this video for Out in the Fields by Gary Moore and see how hard it makes us cry. That was not what I expected. I think it has to do with the
Very.
fact that you gave me that slow, melancholy thing and then you dropped this rock anthem on me.
Yeah. This is very lively and grand. Yeah.
It's spectacular. I mean, as
Little
usual, I
clips.
was distracted by a lot of stuff in the video, but just listening to the music, that's pretty spectacular. And I was right. They said in the beginning, they said, it's the Troubles. So I'm
Yeah,
thinking of the
Phil
right
said
time period.
Troubles.
Yeah, I am thinking of the right time period.
And I've seen this before, but I didn't even call it. Didn't even know that they call it Troubles, so I thought he was using a euphemism.
No, in a way he is,
Yeah.
in that sense. But when I see it referred to in history books and such, it is capitalized as though it has become a proper noun describing the period and the events. So there's that. I did find it very interesting that their costume choice for much of the video was evocative of 1700 and 1800s uniforms, military uniforms. That's very
I still
interesting.
I couldn't recognize what time they're from.
Yeah, it makes me think of 1700s, 1800s military uniforms, especially Napoleonic times military uniforms.
That was deliberate, but I don't know why. And this is how I feel about the world. It's pretty sad, but there's no communication, no one to take the blame. The cries of every nation have fallen on deaf ears again.
Yeah. The other thing that struck me was the repetition of the idea that it doesn't matter what you believe, it won't protect you from being shot. And I liked that, not least because it doesn't say anything about the rightness or wrongness of the cause. It doesn't say anything about whether or not the shooting should happen. It's merely saying, it doesn't matter what you believe, it won't protect you. The side you're on won't protect you. There's
Yeah,
no
the cause, the flag,
intrinsic,
the uniform.
there's no intrinsic protection in what you're wearing, in what you believe, in the color of your skin.
And I
And
guess a lot of religious people expect to be protected by their higher power.
yeah, that too. And that was mentioned. No religion. And I like that. I think that's very interesting. And given both the specific context in which they placed the song and the more general context of the anti-war movements of the late 60s and 70s, it's interesting that they should touch on that rather than it being a polemic against war in general. I mean, there is an element of, war doesn't make sense kind of buried under there, but most of it is just about if war happens, you're not safe.
Yeah.
That there's no protection from violence, which I
Just a
think is,
heartbeat away.
yeah, it, I think, I feel like that's a bit different from the usual route that anti-war, anti-violence, or songs of that type from the 70s take. They usually
It's
more,
not simplistic.
yeah, it's not at all simplistic, and I liked it.
And all of these very thoughtful lyrics in this very quick, fast driving rock
Yeah.
song.
Oh, the beat was so nice and the guitar work. And something else I noticed, I'm used to thinking of elements like the bit where the camera was attached to the guitar. I'm used to thinking of that as very modern. I'm used to thinking of that as explicitly associated with the rise of things like GoPros as a camera type. And here it's clear that's not true. That's not true at all. They were doing that kind of work back in the 70s. I would be interested to understand how the technology worked because I don't think they had cameras as small then. I could be wrong.
This is 85,
Okay.
late 80s.
I still
They
don't
were
think they
small,
had.
probably more expensive than they are today.
That's true. But
It's not that modern.
I
And I
thought
love
that
it because I love guitars and guitar players, so
I
it
love
kind
to
of
be able to
feels
watch their
like,
hands move on it. That's really nice. Yeah.
And the
Although it is
illusion
a
that the
bit
whole world
jarring to
revolves
get
around
used
them.
to the way that it makes your view of things. That's weird.
And this man is one of my favorite guitar players, and at the same time, one of my favorite singers. There's not just the power of his voice, but also this sort of vulnerability.
Yeah.
And they put a bit of echo on his vocals in this one, and it was great. It's a great
Yeah.
song.
Another element that I really liked out of video is the couple of bits where you see them in the studio recording. And I always like to watch that because you get, I don't know if you do, but I will occasionally get this sort of image in my mind of recording. That when they're doing the recording, somehow the passion you hear in the song is not apparent in their bodies, in their faces. Like they'll be all emotional on tour, but not in the studio. And I like being proved wrong with that because he was clearly all the passion in the way he was moving his head and stuff. I liked that. I like to see that.
Well, you should see the growly and the bleh boys in the studio. They're hanging out there.
Okay.
Let's go to a slower one. This one's called Empty Rooms, again from 85.
Okay, hold on a second.
Gary's on his own this time, just playing guitar and singing.
Even Buddy is making a sad face at me. He does not want to learn to live without love.
Did he hear the song?
No. No, I have the headphones on, but he's still making a sad face at me and looking out the window like he's looking for love.
Yeah, in an empty room.
The room is not empty. I am here, Buddy.
That's what you're doing. After a heartbreak, you learn to live without love. You
That is
find love in yourself, in other
not.
people, but that's what it felt like to me both times.
That is not what I did when I had my heart broken.
Weren't you like learning something new?
No. No, it felt more like, it felt more like going back to an old familiar grayness.
Yeah, that's a thing too.
There was did I think the idea of learning to live without love is more connected to people who the idea of having love, of being loved, is their default. And for me, that's rarely been true. I don't want to say that I necessarily value what I have more because of that. That's not neither fair nor accurate. But it's true that my default experience is really about believing that I'm not loved, that I am possibly even unlovable. But certainly the idea of being loved, of being cared about, is an experience that for me, even now, after I've been married to this person for over 10 years, we've been together for almost 20, there are still times when I look at him and I go, I can't believe you're still here.
Yeah, so it doesn't feel like learning to you,
No.
not this thing.
No, for me, the learning experience is learning to live with love, is to acknowledge and believe and accept that the love is there and it is reliable and I will get to keep it.
And how does he do this thing with the voice where he
I
sounds like
don't
he's
know.
crying?
I don't know.
But he's singing through it. It's amazing.
I wonder if it's, how do I put this? I wonder if it's an artifact of layering. If there's like a double tracking effect in there that on the one hand he's, there's a track where he is crying or something, and then they'd record another take of the same lyrics where he's not. I don't know. I don't make sense.
Or he can somehow make it a bit more nasal.
I mean, he's
Not
clearly
the
got
chewy
really
kind.
good vocal control, and that's not, I don't want to say that's not difficult, but it's certainly not impossible.
I love
Yeah.
this one too.
Well, I feel like for you in particular, that's a very valid kind of song. That you've had
Especially
that.
because it says she.
Does it? Well, that's true, it does. I was not paying as much attention as I could have been. You're right. So yeah, for you
Hope
in
that she would
particular,
change her mind.
this is a very valid kind of song that describes an experience that you've had. I still want to
And
punch
a
her.
nice melody.
I still want to punch her, by the way.
Who, my ex?
No, your mother.
Oh, okay. No, I was talking
That
about my
was
ex.
the context I was thinking of.
No. My ex from 5 years ago.
Oh,
That's when I
no, I
was
don't want to
learning to live
punch
without her.
her. I don't want to punch
Yeah,
her.
she's
I
great.
just, she lost, she made a mistake. I'm just gonna go with that.
L I learned to live without her love gradually long ago, and then I just fucked off my mom.
Okay.
So that's not the case. My mom
Okay.
is more like songs like In the End by Linkin Park,
Okay.
or Numb by Linkin Park, or Narcissistic Cannibal by Korn.
Okay. All
That
right, all right. We'll get to those then. Okay.
Let's listen to Still Got the Blues from 1990, Gary Moore's
Okay.
biggest album, most successful album.
So this is the one you think I might know. All right. All
And
right.
this one is live, a live performance. We'll get it from
Okay.
YouTube.
Let me go grab the correct link. All right, let's listen to Still Got the Blues by Gary Moore and see if Panya remembers this. No, don't know that song, but wow. Can I just keep that guitar bit at the end and play it on loop for a little while?
Sure, we have editing software. You can make yourself a loop track. A loop track. There's a comment below that says, "His guitar cries, he cries, I cry, you cry, everybody cries."
The guitar was definitely crying. Wow. How do you make a guitar do that?
You are Gary Moore and you grab a Gibson Les Paul. And
Apparently.
then everybody learned from him.
Apparently. Wow. That was
It's
crazy. Jana, what are you doing?
what is she doing?
Why are you trying to dig a hole in the box? Miss Jenna.
She's constructing.
Cardboard eating goblin. Carrots weren't enough for you? You gotta eat cardboard now? Miss! Excuse me.
Young lady, get out of there!
And these long crying notes is, I think, what some people around their 60s call the feel. So they listen to another guitar player that doesn't evoke the same emotions in them, and they go, this guy doesn't have the feel.
Oh, please.
They can't really define it. But if you ask them, they will say Gary Moore has the feel. Maybe Steve Vai doesn't, but Gary Moore has the feel.
Okay. I thought the feels was a modern invention.
There's no S at the end. The feel.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Or the feeling. He plays with no feeling.
That's just nonsense. Mm-hmm. Just. Maybe there is no just. There is no just. There is no justice. Ow.
Also, America, how could you not play this genius song to my friend who is my age? Like,
what makes you think it's America's fault?
Well, you're in America. You've never heard it. So it's America's
Maybe that
fault.
Has more to do with the fact that I don't listen to the radio?
I was raised listening to the radio.
Yeah, see, there was radio in the car, and that was kind of it. And while I will grant you that it might have come on at some point when I was very small and we were taking the long 8-hour drives to visit the grandparents, but I have no memory of that. The song is not familiar.
Hmm.
And I don't hold a lot of memories from those days anyway.
Hmm.
Certainly no memories of, well, very, very few memories of music.
Mm-hmm. There are lives without Still Got the Blues. And I just fixed this for one person.
You
this
did. You did. Yes. See, that is how come the universe did not have me listen to it before. It was to give you the opportunity to introduce me to it.
Oh, okay.
That's how that works.
So this was a huge hit for Gary. Still the song he is most known from. And a song that I bet young guitar players are in a hurry to learn when they're beginning. And now let's listen to another from the same album, Walking by Myself.
Okay. Is it also going to be crying guitars?
This is a very cute I'm in love with you and I wouldn't hurt you, baby.
Oh, okay. Favorite. So it's a cute romantic kind of song. All right, let's listen to Walking by Myself by Gary Moore. I don't even know.
That's what he said, yeah.
Guitar wail. It's not crying, but it is wailing. Or screaming. Mm. It's screaming, really. It's grim.
I give you all my... Dave. Nice. He didn't need to sing. He could play it.
Yeah. I feel like, again, I didn't know that one, but I feel like I should know that one more. It's more likely that I would know that one than Still Got the Blues.
Could be. This one was big, too. And this sounds like me when I'm in love.
That is true. That is true.
Is this, how do you know how I sound when I'm in love? I do love you, but I'm not like...
I've only been listening to you be in love with various artists for 3 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
That is love too. Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay.
I'm a very observant friend, and I know how you think.
Yeah. Panya agrees. This is what I sound like when I'm in love.
Yep. Yes, Jana? No, we know what you sound like when you're in love. Actually, we know what you sound like when you're in lust, which is not the same thing, Jana.
Yeah.
Cats be crazy.
Walking by myself.
Don't want to walk by myself. Want to walk with my lover and swing their hand.
Yeah. Just wants to be your loving man.
Mm.
That's it. It's also because I become a bit of a clown. I want to make the other person laugh. And it's always made me feel strange because I thought it was the dude that is supposed to make the girl laugh. Like, am I the dude? No, I get
No,
to be whatever I want.
it doesn't matter. But basically, if you're in a romantic relationship and you can't laugh with and at each other, find a new partner. Johnny, you thief!
What did she take?
Oh, I've got a toy over here that I'm waggling around for her, and she just yanked it out of my hand.
Well, that's what the kitty wants.
She can't.
That's
See, she wants me to hold it for her. So when she smacks it out of my hand, I have to pick it up or she sulks.
Yeah. If you're playing, you're playing.
Bop.
And the last one is going to be a Fleetwood Mac cover because apparently I don't know much about Fleetwood Mac,
Okay.
but
Fleetwood
there
Mac is
was
what happens when you put a bunch of musicians who already don't like each other in a room, promise them money and drugs, and then turn them loose.
but it was good, right?
Yeah,
Because
it was good because they were promised money and drugs, but they never liked each other.
Okay, and apparently there was a really good and humorous bluesman there called Peter Green.
Yes.
And this is a song that Peter Green wrote and sang for Fleetwood Mac. It's called If You Be My Baby.
Give me that jazzy blues, baby. Ooh, with the horns and the
Yeah.
swing. Oh.
Nice and long.
Oh. Takes me back to the day, the night I went to jazz club in Detroit. Oh. That was
When
nice.
was that?
Oh, that was a long time ago. That was when Michael's dad was still alive. He took us
You
to,
listen to some live music?
and we went to a jazz club in downtown Detroit. Woo.
Yeah, I guess that is jazzy.
Yeah. It's got them horns, got that horn sound, got the swing. Yeah. That's my second favorite kind of jazz. Is like that. My first favorite is always going to be piano jazz. I'm very fond of piano jazz, but it's not upbeat in the same way. Piano jazz is a bit slower. Ooh.
I remember the first time I heard this one.
And you lost your mind.
I was going to bed listening to the radio. It's sometime in my late 20s, evil secular music.
Oh,
And
yeah, all right.
it was dark, and it's repetitive, but it's intense and it keeps you hooked. So I
Yeah.
was like, oh, what is this? And then I heard Gary's voice. Oh, it's Gary Moore. And he kept making these nice promises. I'm going to keep you satisfied. And then he plays a bit more. And then he comes back and he makes more promises. It was so charming.
He makes the same promise over and over and over.
Yeah,
Although he does
with
say
different
something
people.
about how I'm supposed to cook him meals in the day, and I'm going, I don't know, I don't know. We might need to renegotiate some bits of this.
Yeah, and then love him all night long. Honey, if you're the breadwinner, you'll be tired.
At some
You'll be
point,
sleeping all night long.
we're gonna need to sleep. We're gonna have to renegotiate some of the timing of this. Some of the timing, yeah. However, I do like the idea of being kept satisfied. That seems nice. Yeah.
And it was very simple, very, very simple promises.
Yeah.
And it's kind of nice.
On the other hand, those are the most dangerous kind. Simple promise. That's quite genuinely and literally, that is how lawyers earn their pay, is by making sure that promises are not simple and that there are no loopholes. Because holy cow, promise I will keep you satisfied. Oh, there's so many loopholes in that. So many. Right, Jenna?
But the the joy that he sings it with, and the fact that it's
Yeah.
just a song, it
Yeah, no,
lets
we
you
don't
dream
have
a
to
little
take it
bit.
seriously. Yeah, no. It can mean whatever you need it to mean at the time.
If you be my baby is an alternate universe, believe these promises and just sway.
Yeah. And on the bridge part, we'll do more than just sway. You can swing me up and around and do all kinds of swing moves. That's the sort of song I think I would love to hear used on Strictly Come Dancing or what are the other dancing shows? Ones like that.
It's pretty slow though. I'm used to swing being faster.
It can be faster. But there are, honestly, I think it would be more interesting to see swing performed to a slower song like this because it changes the requirements of the moves. You can do the same moves, but something that you can pull off in swing if you're moving quickly, like some of those pick up and swing someone around moves, are harder if you're doing them more slowly because you have to keep holding someone up. And I think that would be interesting. I think that would be very interesting. It's also, I believe, true that for a number of those shows, the pieces that they perform are not. Some of them are. They're expected to have some elements that are by strict ballroom competition rules, but they're allowed to have other elements that are not as strict for fun. So that would also be interesting. Maybe we can get Riker
True.
come back and he can talk about his experience with that. That would be interesting. So that was Gary Moore. Okay.
Yeah, he was born in 52. We lost him to a heart attack in 2011. So he was 59.
That's pretty good. Pretty good for a musician. And heart attacks are. There's things you can do to try to prevent that, but sometimes it's just going to creep up and get you.
The Wikipedia does say that he had a lot of alcohol in his blood, a dangerous dose of alcohol. So that's
Okay.
maybe one thing that contributed. He was not a happy fellow. They say he was never happy with himself or with his music, rarely happy with his music.
It sounds like he might have been a perfectionist. And of course, being Irish, and at that time, I guarantee you that there was that the conflict of the Troubles reached all the way down into his relationships with just like people around him. The same way
Probably.
that like the ideological conflicts in the United States right now are dividing friendships and families. It's the same thing. It's the same like how Murari just tried to pick a fight with Buddy.
Damn it. Why?
Because she wanted to wrestle. And he wouldn't wrestle and she fluffed off.
Didn't happen.
Nope, he refused. He's fine with no as long as he's the one saying it.
Otherwise, people just have to agree and
Well,
accept.
yeah, in Cat Chat this episode, we learned that Buddy does not really understand the concept of consent. We haven't gotten Jana fixed. She's still a whole girl cat, but there are no whole male cats in the house. However, when Jana's in heat, if you ask them, they're whole. Especially Buddy. Especially Buddy. And I've had a lot of cats in my life, okay? I've had a lot of cats. Buddy is literally, genuinely the only cat I have ever encountered who is actually bisexual. I'm not
And also
really.
very horny.
And very, very horny. I genuinely don't know what triggers it when he tries to mount Kronos, who is a boy cat, because Kronos obviously doesn't go into heat and also doesn't have any balls. So I don't know what triggers that, but there are definitely times when he tries to do that, And Kronos is very confused and doesn't really approve and clearly says no. But he's also, I guess the best way to put it is I hate using this kind of trope, but Kronos is a beta male. He's not dominant. He is mm-hmm. not particularly pushy. He is easily bullied. And so when Buddy says, I'm going to try to fuck you, Kronos just kind of takes it.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing it last night, and I finally had to get up and chase Buddy off of him because it was clear that Kronos did not want but did not have the courage to do anything to really push Buddy away.
Mm-hmm. Rowdy behavior.
To be fair, none of my cats are particularly... They don't hiss and swat more than a little bit. Like, that, we rarely have them be in fights or conflicts where they're genuinely trying to hurt each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of that is, you know, we've taught them not to do that. But it does mean that when Buddy gets pushy, they may feel like they have no recourse. I don't know. And what's really funny is that when Janna goes into heat, Buddy is perfectly willing to do his ballless best to help her out. And she has zero interest in him.
Oh,
I have literally seen him mount her and her be crawling on the floor toward Kronos while Buddy's trying to help. Like, she just has no interest whatsoever. She wants Kronos, and Kronos is not interested, but that's because he's old. Kronos has no interest in sex, period. So it's just like, why do we have this ridiculous love triangle of cats? I don't understand. Cats is crazy.
What a situation. But yeah. Does Buddy take breaks from his horniness?
Yeah,
his
actually. Periods? He does. Okay. He is most horny when Janna is in heat, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
He is wound up by the hormones that she's emitting, and so that's the way it happens. Mm-hmm. And Janna's been particularly ridiculous the last week or so anyway. I was having dinner on Thursday, and I had some sliced carrots as part of my dinner. And because I am clumsy, I dropped one on the floor and she promptly went, "What's this? What's this?" And went and sniffed it and licked it a couple of times. And I thought, okay, I'll let her lick it and then I'll take it away. I did not take it away. Spoiler alert, she picked the thing up in her teeth and just shot off down the hall.
Yeah.
And she'd pause about every 6 feet and stop and put it down and try to eat it and then notice that I was coming and pick it up and trot off again. All purposeful. And she stuck her head into the computer room where the husband was and looked like she was going to pause and try to eat it again and then noticed he was there and trotted off again. When she got all the way to the far end of the house into the bedroom, I gave up. And I've mentioned before, this is a very large house. So, you know, I was chasing her for a good 5 minutes before I finally gave up, you know, with the trotting off and the pausing and the trotting off.
I wish I'd seen this.
It's ridiculous. And it's not like she's not bolting in like a flat out, ears back, tail streaming kind of run. It's a very purposeful kind of trot, but it's not slow.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not, you know, the whole long pause everywhere gallop.
Mm. And so she experienced the carrot.
She did experience.
You think it's the first time she experienced a carrot?
As far as I know, it's the first time she experienced a carrot.
Mm-hmm.
We typically don't let them have people food. We certainly don't normally let them steal people food.
Yeah.
You know, if they get people food, it's because we offered it to them.
Mm-hmm.
But of the cats that we've had, since husband and I got married, she is the only one who genuinely begs for people food. None of the others have ever begged for it. They're curious. They'll sniff if you bring food around them, but they don't go looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
The cat that husband and I first had together was, was a cat that he had adopted sometime before he met me, and then Phoebe stayed with his mom for a little while, And then his mom decided that she could no longer give Phoebe the things that she needed. And I adopted Phoebe. And I was having steak one night and didn't finish it. And just put the plate on the counter intending to, you know, put the leftovers away or throw it away or something later. And Phoebe hopped up on the counter, went straight to the steak, sniffed it, and then threw her head up and walked away and sat in the window. Didn't even try to taste it, nothing. And that was mostly my experience with the cats that I have with husband and people food is they want to smell it. You know, they're curious, but after they've figured out that it's not their food, they're like, nah, I'm not interested. Jana, on the other hand, will steal things. She will get up on the counter, which she knows she's not supposed to do, and try to steal things. She will lick gravy. If you're eating it, she needs to know. And when she's not trying to eat people food, she's chewing plastic and cardboard and Lord knows what else.
Mm-hmm.
She's
our little. She wants the experience.
She wants to eat all the things. And I just heard Thunderpaws down the hall, but my back is to the door, so I don't know what's going on.
What is that, Thunderpaws?
Well, we have wood floors, so when a kitty is running, you can hear them. Aha! Mm-hmm. They just tore into here. Jana is chasing Mirari. If the two of you chase each other across this desk, there will be problems. Jana, do not. Thank you. Mirari doesn't seem unhappy. Her tail is still sticking straight up in the air and curling, but there was definitely chasing and snapping. What are you doing, Miss Mirari? Come here. Ow! That didn't work. Come here.
She wouldn't come.
Oh, no. Okay, I was trying to pick her up off of the desk and the headphone cord wasn't long enough. And so I jerked my head. Yes, Miss Fluff. Yes. You're gonna sniff the microphone. Good girl. Boop boop. Oh. Oh. So much fluff. Oh, you're so much fluff.
You'll be coughing in a second.
I'll be sneezing because she's sticking her fur up my nose. Yes. Yes, I see those airplane ears. Oh, we got fighter jet ears. Oh, how about scritches? Scritches make it better? Scritches make it better. Okay, give kiss. Good girl. Yep. Fur up my nose. It is shedding season. I brushed her and Buddy yesterday and got enough fur to make a kitten. A fairly large kitten at that.
What do you mean shedding season? Isn't it all the time?
No. No, shedding season is... So, I mean, different cats behave different ways. But in general, especially in around here and points farther north, many cats will grow a thicker coat in the winter. And then when warmer weather comes, they will shed it. So, genuinely, literally, my cats... Jana does not. But Buddy and Mirari in particular get thicker coats in the winter. And then in the spring, there's tumbleweeds of cat fur that they have shed. And I do brush them, but they don't always enjoy it. But yesterday we had a serious brushing session and there was enough fur in the brush that I had to clean it out two or three times. And then there was enough fluff to make a whole other kitten. And not a small kitten either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it does
not... So this is just...
Go on.
This is just from me listening to people who are being ironic about their huskies, maybe, or about their Labradors. All the time is shedding season. An actual shedding season exists.
It does. It does. Huskies in particular are, I think, a strange... Huskies probably do have shedding season all the time because... Their breed and their coats are really developed and designed for cold. So I would bet that huskies that live in Finland or in the north of Canada or Alaska probably don't shed quite as much.
If it's
Whereas,
high up north, yeah.
a husky that lives in Greece or in Florida or California, well, Southern California, probably does shed all the frickin' time. And that correlates with what I was about to say about Mirari. Mirari is a ragdoll breed and they have long fur. They are very fluffy. It's probably fair to say that if you simply look at Mirari on the Instagram, her actual body size is about half of what you see there. She has that much fluff. It's like, I don't know, a finger length deep of my hands. So, while she does shed some in the winter, there is an increased incidence of shedding in the late spring, which we are rapidly approaching. It's going to be, I don't know what it translates to in Celsius, but it's supposed to be 80 degrees here Fahrenheit tomorrow, which is a temperature that I associate with summer weather. So summer
Somewhere
weather
between
is,
20 and 30 then.
yeah, summer weather is rapidly approaching. And although we keep the house at a fairly cool 70 degrees Fahrenheit, at least it's cool for me. Like me, cat bodies tend to react as much to the outdoor temperature as the indoor temperature. So, interestingly, for all that Mirari sheds a lot, unlike almost all the other cats I've ever had, she does not seem to get hairballs. I rarely find
Where?
her throwing up.
Throwing up,
Yeah, like she'll wash herself. She's a tidy girl. But she doesn't seem to swallow it to the point of having it build up in her gut and needing to throw it up. Which is nice because let me tell you, stepping on a fresh hairball is one of the most disgusting things known to humans.
Yes, I have done that.
Especially barefoot. There are maybe three really awful things to step on barefoot. One of them is a Lego, and another is a fresh cat hairball. It's just really horrible. I don't recall that I've ever actually stepped on a Lego. And I think I'm going to keep it that way.
I have lived in a house with a puking cat, a furball puking cat, but I was never barefoot. I remember cleaning those.
I really prefer to be barefoot, even in the winter, which means I get cold toes a lot. Because my circulation isn't great, but I'd still rather be barefoot than have socks on. It's just,
And
it's a
then I tell
thing.
you to put on socks, and you say you're not comfortable in socks, and you're
Yeah.
just cold. Bunny is cold.
Well, I get fluffy blankets and I wrap them around my feet, and that helps. And if I would get up and move around more, it wouldn't be as much of a problem. But I get hyper focused on something and I will literally forget to pee. I'll be
Why don't you
absorbed.
get a walking desk?
I will bite you. I will bite you. Girl.
I hear office people love that shit, but
There are
it just seemed
standing
like a
desks
mouse on
at
a
the
treadmill.
that there's there are standing desks at the office, and I tried that, and I spent the next day wishing that I hadn't because the arthritis in my knee said, "What are you doing? Excuse me." So, no, I genuinely just need to remember to get up and move around. It's not even just about moving my feet, it's about standing up and stretching my back and getting the blood flow moving in my arms as well as my legs and breaking the hyperfocus fascination. Because,
I gotta be reminding you of that then.
yeah, because like I said, if I get deeply into hyperfocus, I have been known to sit at a computer, shifting only slightly for 6 to 8 hours, and then realize when I come out of it that I haven't eaten anything, I haven't peed, and my neck hurts. It doesn't happen like that very often, but it has been known to happen, and then I wonder why I don't feel good. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, guys, remind your hyper-focusing friends to get up.
and move around, yes. And we'll say, but
And
my
to
focus,
eat.
and you can tell us it'll come back, because it will.
Yeah.
If
Okay.
something is fascinating enough to draw you into hyperfocus to begin with, it'll come back.
So what author are we going to talk about today?
So the last time we recorded, we fell into a discussion about Heinlein, and I mentioned that there had been a book published after his death that was completed by an author called Spider Robinson. I believe his actual legal name was John, but I have to look it up.
I like this.
You
I'll just
like?
call myself Spider.
Yeah, well, he did in fact adopt it from both a musician that he liked, Spider John Connor, when there was something else. Oh
He
wow,
looks
his
like an old-time
given
rock
name is
musician.
actually not even written here. Nobody knows what his
Yeah.
given name was anymore. He's been called Spider for so long.
Oh, he was born in 48, yeah.
Yeah, he's been called Spider for so long. Yeah, I have no idea what his first name actually is. Possibly
They don't talk
he.
about his family.
There doesn't seem to be a lot known. But apparently he legally changed it at some point. There are two specific groups of books for which he is known. One of them is the absolutely pun-laden short story collections collectively known as Callahan's Cross Time Saloon. The saloon, the bar of the title, is located somewhere in upstate New York. It's never really made specific, which is just as well, and is operated by Callahan, who, as it turns out, is in fact a time traveler and a number of other things, and his bar tends to collect odd people. And by odd people, I mean there's a story where the antagonist, such as it is implied strongly to be Hitler. The denizens of the bar prevent several alien invasions, one of which they manage to prevent by slipping the android in the bar a Mickey Finn, literally. As
A
in,
what?
a Mickey Finn is a shorthand for something that will knock you out. A knockout potion. And the Once they knock him out once, he can't send the android can't send the signal for the alien invasion, and he only has this one chance to send it. So after they've knocked him out once, he becomes a friend, a patron of the bar. There are so many characters just in and out of Callahan's. For the most part, the Callahan books are collections of short stories with little linking in between them, except that they feature the same barflies in the same bar. But as you move along throughout the stories, they do tend to become longer until the last one. What's the last one called? I can't remember. Callahan's Key and Callahan's Con become full-blown novels in their own right. And there are just tons and tons and tons of different characters and different interesting things that happen. Not all of them are explicitly supernatural. There is a story called The Time Traveler, which in fact refers to a completely possible form of time travel, in that the title character was locked up in a banana republic some 30 years before the story began and had zero or next to zero contact with what was going on in the outside world. And so when he's released after 30 some years, it's as if he's traveled through time. And when you're talking about a story where the setting is, the time setting is usually in the late 80s, a lot of things happened between the mid 50s and the mid 80s. If you lose that chunk of time and you don't have any idea what happened through history there, you did. You time traveled. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of insane. And there are a great many stories where the base underlying theme comes down to empathy. That people will stumble into the bar struggling with some problem, desiring death, in despair, something like that. And through the ears, through the friendliness of the barflies and their camaraderie with each other, they are, the characters are induced to speak what hurts them and are then forgiven or empathized with or something that helps them to feel better. Sometimes they stay. Sometimes they just needed that and they move on. In some cases, the ease that is brought to the suffering character is brought through humor, where they, somebody at the bar manages to say something that gets them to see the funny side of the whatever it is, and they're able to break out of their despair that way. There are, there is a related duology, I guess, referred to as Callahan's Lady, who is the titular Callahan's wife, and she runs a brothel in New York City, I think it is. There are not as many stories. There's only the two books of short stories there. And it is heavily emphasized throughout the story that this is the absolutely most ethical brothel that he could find the way to put words around.
Oh.
That they are paid very well. They are given plenty of time off. They are in no wise allowed to be abused in a way that they don't consent to. That kind of thing. And especially in the Lady Sally duology, there are a couple of stories that absolutely feature somebody trying to break those rules and them getting the tar beat out of them one way or the other. In at least one case, in one of the stories, I believe that the result was to turn back on the abuser what they were doing. And if I remember correctly, that particular one was a technological thing that they were doing. And so they managed to simply turn the tables and then kicked that person out.
I'm always glad when people can imagine things ethically this way.
Right. It is. They're not very patronizing
a worker and telling them, oh, you're immoral or your job is awfully dangerous and...
Yes.
No, hon, it's not.
As I recall, somebody tries that with in one of the Lady Sally stories, and the employees are not having any of it. They are genuinely not having with that. Pretty much every single story features puns somewhere. Anytime I read these stories, I will have to pause every story or so and just groan because this is my reaction to puns. I believe that it's put best by the quality of pun is expressed in the oi of the beholder. Yeah.
Yeah. When in chat, when I tell Panya puns, she sends me a nut.
I send her a peanut because the...
Why?
Well, I actually particularly did pick that up from Callahan's. One of the featured elements in a couple of Callahan stories is that they do, in fact, occasionally have punning contests, and the best or worst puns are greeted with a shower of peanut shells, cocktail napkins, and the denizens of the bar fleeing into the night holding their noses.
But what do you mean worst puns? All puns are good.
That's an argument we're going to
Okay.
have at some other point. I defer this discussion. I mean,
Running out, holding your nose. Wow.
insofar as the quality of the puns in the books, I cannot possibly comment. However, you may read them for yourself at any time and make your own judgment as to whether or not they are good puns or bad puns.
Okay.
Another common element in the Callahan stories is there is a fireplace in the bar, as one might expect of a bar of those days and in that area. And sometimes people will make toasts or declare an oath, which is then celebrated by smashing one's shot glass in the fireplace. It is specifically mentioned in at least one story that Callahan buys cheap shot glasses by the caseload precisely for this, and that every week or so he goes in and sweeps out the glass from the fireplace pit. And if your toast or your oath is strong enough, everyone will get a toast and smash their glasses in the pit in solidarity with you. And there are a number of stories where the resolution of the main character's difficulty is triggered by the raising of this kind of toast. And the catharsis of making the toast and breaking the glass. It is not considered done to smash one's glass on the floor or anything like that. Do not be Thor in Callahan's bar. Smash it in the fireplace like everybody else. But smashing in the fireplace is in fact encouraged. And I believe the fireplace is described at some point, and it is mentioned that the construction of the fireplace is such to help prevent shards of glass from spraying back out. So again, there is consideration for the results of this action in a physical manner. That
But is this while the fire is burning?
I think at least a couple of times it is. It's been a while since I've read them, so I'm not 100% sure.
This is a fascinating way to celebrate. I've never been to a Greek, never been to Greece, so maybe I don't know the joy of breaking plates. Maybe there's something nice about it.
There can be something very, very cathartic when you're very wrought up about breaking things. When I was younger and I got very angry, I don't know if it's fair to say that I had been taught explicitly, but it was during a period of time where I was struggling very much with what was acceptable ways to express any emotions that were negative. So if I was very angry, I wanted to destroy things, which is, a common reaction when you're angry. And I finally learned to go outside, and I lived in a wooded area, and I would just pick up sticks and break them against trees. And that was how I dealt with that. And then when I grew older and moved into areas where I didn't have access to a yard full of random sticks, I would buy number two pencils. And if I got that angry, I'd just break the pencils. And I'd buy the really cheap, the kind you have to stick in a pencil sharpener and that kind of thing. And if pencils weren't handy, I'd take some paper that had already been used and rip it to shreds. But that's a little harder to clean up. Bits of paper tend to get more everywhere than number two pencils, which, while they break very with great satisfaction, they don't tend to turn into shards. So, and these days I don't really have that level of anger anymore. And if I get close to that, I'll just grab a pillow and scream. I'm no longer allowed to simply scream because it hurts the husband's ears and offends every cat in the house. But a muffled in by a pillow scream is acceptable. And I frequently will these days give warnings, say, "Excuse me, I need a pillow," and then stalk off, grab a pillow, yell into it. And then when I come back, they're like, "Okay, Are you better now? Yeah. Because you just have to take the edge off.
Yeah.
I don't recall that anywhere in the books features anybody with quite that level of rage. However, the Callahan books were not, in fact, the first books by Spider Robinson that I ever encountered. The first books by Spider that I encountered is the first book of the trilogy known as the Stardance Trilogy. And I tripped over it in college, and it did a number on my thinking about the way humanity's progress through time works, I guess. Mm. It's honestly kind of difficult to describe, but the basic arc of the first story is that humanity is truly beginning to move into space, and so it explores the effect of zero gravity on the human body and on the human mind. And the primary character is a dancer who is not, by the standards of ballet dance as they existed in the 80s and somewhat still today, because she was too large. And not just in the sense that she was too tall, but also in the sense that she actually had breasts.
Yeah.
There is a visual aspect to ballet dancers that they are expected to meet. And if one is tall or well-developed or both, you don't fit. And it's not that you are incapable of the physical aspects of the dance, merely that visually you don't match. And so the lead character's career, a very promising career, was rather cut short by that. And I don't remember how she gets to this, but essentially what she ends up deciding to do is she has someone sponsor her to go into space and learns to do zero gravity dance. Oh. And it's fascinating and it's beautiful, and there's a lot of description of how that works and how regular dance has to be altered, what has to be made different in order to truly achieve zero gravity dance. She begins by attempting to dance in an enclosed space, but as the story progresses, she begins to develop a form of it that involves dancing in free space with maybe some bars and things to help one move around and adjust one's trajectory. And of course, a backpack of thrusters to help one move around.
Oh, free space, like outside of a ship?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, wow.
Right, which if you really think about moving around in space is enormous. It is extremely difficult for any human to truly conceptualize just how huge space is, even just the space around our planet. And so we're talking about a character who is attempting to develop a form of dance where if she screws up much, she's gone.
She'll be floating.
Yeah. She'll just drift out into space forever.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultimate conclusion to the first part of the first novel in the trilogy is actually kind of sad, because she gives this wonderful, amazing performance, and you've learned a lot about her, and you've learned what she had to sacrifice in order to get to where she is. And she chooses at the end of that performance to let that be the end of her everything. And she drops herself in,
Quantum.
she drops herself into the atmosphere.
Oh. Yeah, because she wouldn't want to die floating. Yeah, that would
Right.
be a quicker
She
death.
wants to burn up. She chooses to burn up. And you do come to find out later that she survived, and her survival, the means of her survival, is a significant element in the next two novels. But one of the elements that this book and the trilogy really dropped into my head was the idea of just how hierarchical all human societies are. That there is no human societal construct, starting with parent child and moving up to bigger and bigger groups, that does not involve a hierarchy of power of some sort. I mean, I guarantee you there is no meowster who has not been told at some point by a parental figure, you will do X because I said so. Every single one of us has experienced that. And that's the kind of hierarchy that is it's never explicitly discussed quite in that way, but one of the things that is mentioned in the sections that talk about how living in free fall changes you talks about the fact that it's no longer truly possible to have height differences in free fall. And that if you can adapt your mind to the fact in free fall that is also no longer necessary for everyone to orient themselves in the same direction. You know, on Earth, we are perforce oriented to the pull of gravity. If you're in space in free fall, there is no gravity. There is no down. There is no perforce direction of orientation. And that too changes, at least the book suggests that that changes the way that people interact with each other. Not only does it completely obviate all height differences, because it's always possible to float up and be literally eye to eye with someone, but there are subtle ways with body language, with the way that we interact, that are predicated on the existence of gravity. And that once you start to remove that, the book claims, and I don't know that I believe this entirely anymore, but the part of the book's thesis is that this will also begin to obviate some of humanity's general need for hierarchy, for someone in charge, for the cascade of power,
Well, if it's
which.
some of it came from the fact that men are usually bigger. It could be a thing.
I don't know, but I found that to be a very interesting perspective, especially when I was in college and I was really honestly, not consciously, but aware of looking for new ideas, thinking about things in a different way, being exposed to a lot of things I hadn't experienced before. The second and third novel really, really bring on the, I'm going to call it softer science fiction, because it turns out that the main character of the first book was saved by functionally the intervention of aliens. And there is a what's the word I want? A type of space flora that if you ingest it will provide you with a whole bunch of benefits, including a rebreather mechanism, the ability to move around in space, and the ability to attain energy by photosynthesis. As well as once you have more humans with who have ingested this space flora, you become telepathic with each other.
Oh, the 70s. I'm glad we had it. And that those people wrote those things.
But one of the elements that came out of that within the story was a significant discussion amongst those humans still on Earth who did not ingest the stuff. And a corporation is set up to enable people who want to go into space and partake of this stuff and become part of, but there becomes this discussion of, okay, are these people still human? Do we
Yeah,
have to
that's what I
treat
was
them
thinking.
as one of us? Are we concerned about them using up our resources? And the story makes it quite clear that a huge reason behind the existence of this space flora and the ingestion of it is that it's supposed to free you of the need for human resources. You know, the sun's just going to burn. So if you can derive your energy from photosynthesis and the stuff that surrounds you enables you to breathe and move, you don't need anything else. You're protected from space, so you don't need a space suit. You can just float freely and sleep whenever you like and converse with people, and you don't need to work, and you don't need to. Everything is supplied by merely existing near a star. That's all you need. And there's a lot of people down on Earth in the story that have real trouble conceptualizing that.
Who
They
the best
just,
person if you don't work?
yeah, they just can't hold this idea. They just can't hold this idea, and there are the societal and social difficulties. But one of the things that's mentioned that really, really deeply struck me is one of the characters says something about these the people who ingest the space flora come to refer to themselves as a group as star dancers, because the first person who did it took in was a dancer and danced in the stars, and that was what she called her penultimate composition, was the star dance. So they refer to themselves as star dancers, and someone in one of the books says something about the star dancers being the next evolution of humanity, which scares the heck out of a whole bunch of the more straight-laced people in the book, obviously, because they're immediately going, oh, we're being replaced,
Yeah,
even though the
a
star
new hierarchy.
dancers, yeah. That even though the star dancers, in fact, explicitly say, we're not interested in replacing you and we're not interested in forcing you to come off of Earth. We're only interested in welcoming people who choose to belong to this. And if anybody who wants to stay on Earth, that's fine. We're fine with that. We don't care. You're irrelevant, which is also kind of scary, you know, to be considered irrelevant by someone. But it really struck me at that time in college, the idea that humanity could and was continuing to evolve, and what that might look like, and would we know if there
It's very
were,
slow. I don't know
if
how
there
we would
were,
know.
you know, and I started genuinely at that time doing research on, okay, I understand what evolution is, and I understand things like punctuated equilibrium and stable evolution and all of that kind of thing. And I studied social Darwinism and went, what the heck is this nonsense? And then I started trying to understand how exactly do you decide when a group has speciated? How are different species differentiated from each other, and when is that decision made? And at least at the time, and mind you, this was 25 years ago, at least at the time, I came to understand that there was no answer to that. That even science and biology had not come to a conclusion about that, and that in general, evolution and speciation were not applied to actual what was going on right now, animals. That it was mostly applied to the past, and that even when you dug around in the past, you would find articles and books written that would specifically say that it's not possible to pinpoint the dividing line between this species and that species, that over time it
Yeah.
occurred.
You're just finding, observing changes and making timelines and dating
Right.
things.
Right. And that
But
was one
this
of
you
the
cannot
things
do.
that introduced me very strongly to the idea that humanity is not good with slow change. We're not good with spectrums in that sense. We want dividing lines. We want markers. Yeah. We want specifics. It's why the idea of there being an age of adulthood exists, and it's why that's applied across different cultures in different ways, and why there are always exceptions to that idea. It's the same concept that there is this slow arc, but there's no single point. And there certainly isn't a single point that can be applied to everybody. But one of the interesting things that caused in me was there was absolutely a period of time where I was convinced that I was not human, as in I did not belong to the species group Homo sapiens sapiens.
Bueno, what are you talking about? That sounds like a break from reality.
Yeah.
What was your thinking?
So one of the things that I was thinking was I was comparing myself to a lot of the people around me and realizing that I didn't think like they did. That the patterns of thought that I had, the way that I looked at things, even in my own family, I didn't think like they did. And so I linked that in with this idea of the slow evolution of humanity and the thought that maybe we wouldn't know when what the next evolution was. And I thought, okay, if we define human specifically as Homo sapiens sapiens and they have these traits and this kind of pattern of thought, then I don't think like that. Therefore, I'm not human in that way. And it wasn't so much that I thought of myself as, you know, oh, I'm a space alien or something, so much as it evolved out of this idea that we might not know what the next evolution of humanity was, and maybe I was it, or maybe I was part of it, because I could definitely see around me that there were people I'd made friends with and people I was acquainted with who did think like me. So it wasn't this concept of being alone so much as this concept of how do we define speciation and how do we define humanity? And if these are the rules, then I don't fit in those rules. And so by that definition, I'm not human, but what's the name for what I am? You know, and I never really got any farther than that. And it never really became an enormous part of my thinking in that I would go around and, you know, think that I was better than other people. It was more of a strong conceptualization of being different and trying to understand the whys of that and what it might mean as a long term thing, as opposed to all the short term stuff I was encountering. I did really manage to explode the brains of some of my fellow philosophy students with that one, though. I don't have any real strong memory of what specifically we were discussing in the class that day. I believe it was the ethics class. But something about the way I was responding to some of my fellow students made one of them go, "You sound like you don't think you're human." And I looked him dead in the eye and I went, "I don't."
Yep.
And he starts spluttering and being really confused and going, "She can't say that," and blah blah blah. And the teacher's like, "No, this is interesting. Let's pursue this." And so I did basically exactly what I just did. I said, "Okay, what does it mean to be human? What's the definition of human?" And so he starts listing off these things and I'm going, okay, I don't match that. And it just watching their little brains explode as I present to them the idea that humanity could have such a definition and that someone could look like them and nevertheless still not think of themselves as one of them. And this was...
And maybe still crossbreed with them even.
Yeah. And this was I would say the earliest stages of what I think of now as the queer transformation. The point at which this was before queer marriages became a topic of worldwide discussion, before trans acceptance became the kind of topic of worldwide discussion that it is. This is before there were any, before there were many laws specifically relating to either queer or trans anything. And so I think in a small way, I feel like I kind of contributed to that by getting this classroom full of mostly freshmen to stop and actually think about, okay, here is a person who genuinely doesn't think they belong to the same race as me because they're different. And these are the differences, and they're not visible differences. So, yeah, I don't have any expectation of anybody ever experiencing the Stardance trilogy in the same way that I did. But the time at which I encountered it and the things that I was experiencing, it really gave me some different paths of thought and caused me to look at things in a way that I hadn't been doing before, or that I'd been kind of groping towards but didn't have the words for yet.
So these people could sustain themselves without breathing oxygen, and they could live through fire, and they didn't need to eat food. They just needed sunlight.
Correct. They can still die. And in fact, terrorist attempts on them and on the space flora is a significant element of one of the books. But in general, it is presented as though once you ingest this stuff, you are functionally immortal and all your needs are met in the simplest possible way. That the only unmet needs are the mental, emotional sort. And so a star dancer requires sunlight and other people. And that's it. They are.
If I'm going up there, I need to know that there are therapists up there.
Well, as in pretty much every single thing that Spider Robinson ever wrote, the idea is that humans in reasonably small, empathetic, compassionate groups form therapy for each other. That once you are put in touch with a group of people who are willing to listen to whatever you say, who are always going to attempt to understand you, and who are always going to attempt to forgive, although that's not quite the right word, anything that you might have done in your past, a lot of human hang-ups go away or can be resolved, can be eased.
But since I can't be sure that the group is going to be like that, I want to know that there are professionals up there star dancing if I'm going to be doing that.
I mean, as far as the base trilogy goes, since the majority of star dancers are people from Earth, I guarantee you that there's at least one therapist who went, I'm curious, I'm going to do the thing.
Oh, yeah.
And if they're telepathic with each other, then there you go.
Oh, yeah. That's a good environment for them.
Yeah. So the best way to sum up the major underlying empathetic theme of all of Spider Robinson's books is by quoting what is referred to as Callahan's Law. Shared pain is lessened, shared joy increased. Thus do we refute entropy.
What was entropy? Remind me.
Loss of energy, the heat death of the universe.
That's a nice law. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
About shared pain and shared happiness.
Yeah. Another way of putting it that is also quoted in the books is there are laws of conservation of pain and joy, just as there are laws of conservation of matter and energy. Neither can ever be created or destroyed, but one can be converted into the other. I don't find that one to be quite as accurate, but it is a very good perspective on the idea that it is possible to convert pain into joy through the right alchemies. And most of those alchemies involve human empathy and compassion.
Because you will always be feeling things.
Yeah.
I guess.
You will always be feeling things. And as I think most meowsters have experienced, trying not to feel usually just results in some kind of volcanic explosion at some point. Mm-hmm. Not good for you. It's just not good for you.
The people who were working and forming their views in the 70s seem to really love these ideas of union and empathy.
Yes,
it telepathy.
It was a strong thread. There was.
I want it back.
There was this conviction that if we could only know what each other was thinking, then it would be possible to resolve all differences.
Mm.
As I have moved through time and gotten older, I find that to be less accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that if it was possible to communicate more clearly without some of the inherent misunderstandings that are derived from language, that more people would be able to get along, but I no longer believe that telepathy would engender a total lack of conflict. I no longer believe that. But I do believe that if there was a way to communicate that removed the language barrier, even between two speakers of the same language, there would be less conflict. There would still be points where we didn't agree with each other. But it's easier, in my opinion, to deal with those once you're actually clear on what your ideas are.
Mm-hmm.
There have been any number of times where, especially with my sister, where we've been talking about something and we think that we disagree when we start the conversation. And then as we work our way through it and we clarify for each other and ask each other questions, we come to realize that what we ultimately want is the same thing. We just were thinking about getting there by different paths. And there are, that's a circumstance that's happened quite a lot with me, is if I have the patience and the other person has the patience to work their way through the confusions engendered by different understandings of the same word, you often find that what you want ultimately is the same, and either your concept of how to get there is different or your concept of the possibility of it is different.
Mm-hmm.
And then
the time and patience to do that.
It's
we
tricky.
Don't have that with most people.
It's tricky. And it does take time. And we live in a culture that has placed such a premium on moving quickly that I think I don't want to say we've lost the ability to be patient, but it's no longer the first thing that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
To slowly work your way through a long conversation.
I'm tempted to quickly judge whether a person is on my side or against me, and then I'm out.
Right.
And that's not good.
Whereas spider stories consistently chase the idea that there's no such thing as sides, that sides are an artificial imposition on the general way that humanity works.
Yeah.
Or to borrow a lyric from one of my favorite musicals, Chess, nobody's on nobody's side. The only true side is your own, and therefore everybody is in one way or another against you, and therefore discard the entire idea of sides because it's irrelevant. If everyone is against you, there's no point in chasing it or arguing with it. Just learn to be good to people. I don't know. That didn't come out particularly coherently, did it?
No, I get it. This reminded me of a book that blew my mind when I was a teenager. Robert Silverberg's A Time of Changes from 71.
I've read
And
that once. It's been a very long time.
he found a drug that creates something of a mind meld. You see people's memories, you feel their feelings if you both take the drug at the same time. And he lived in a world where he wasn't even allowed to say I and me. He had to say this man's feelings are very confused. And the only people who you could be honest with were these priests, and they were, they would keep your secret. What's it called in the Catholic Church? I forgot. You
Confession?
go and confess. Yeah, and the people who confess you, priests. Don't know. But that was their job, and they kept your secrets. And even if you went to them, you were still not allowed to say I. That was the grammar there. This person, this woman. And he stumbled upon this drug because he met a guy that came from Earth. This is many, like thousands of years after people went to other planets and created other cultures. And this guy came from Earth with this drug, and our character took it with a brother and then with a sister, but like a bonded brother. And a lot of people took it very negatively.
Right.
And he just wanted to keep going and keep mind melding with people because he was so thirsty for
For
contact.
connection. Yeah. And
And they
while
were
it
after
is
him.
not as, I don't want to say not as common, but it's not as emphasized in more modern science fiction in this way of telepathy and such, the idea of human connection. And the idea of there being some way to improve that is still a very strong theme in modern science fiction. Yeah. Here's your dose of the things that the 70s were doing with their beautiful bluesy music and their desire for greater connection and their concerns of war.
Well, yeah, guys, thank you for listening. Remember to take your pills, eat well,
Yep.
and especially if someone's tried to teach you that you don't need much to eat to you don't need much to you don't need to eat much to survive.
They're liars.
Screw
Eat what
that.
you want.
Yeah, and as much
Incidentally,
as you want.
speaking of that, I have been on a pilgrimage for the last 3 months to acquire Ben and Jerry's Dublin Mudslide flavor ice cream. They had it for a while, about a decade ago. They brought it back during the pandemic. I was able to find it at the grocery store once and bought like 4 pints. And once those were gone, I couldn't find it anymore. I finally ordered it from Amazon last night and it came in and I have my ice cream. Do not let anybody tell you you should not have the things you want. Find a way to get them. Pursue them
Chase them.
relentlessly.
Hunt and gather them. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So, yes, eat the good things, take care of yourself, take your meds, remember to eat more than just ice cream though. You know, my insanity notwithstanding, eat more than just ice cream. And grow your hair as long as you like and listen to the good music. Yeah. Bye, guys.